Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. Today, episode 186, The Carlisle Peace Commission. A couple of weeks ago, I covered the British as they sent General William Howe back to London following a big party in Philadelphia. A couple of weeks after Howe departed, another ship, the Trident, arrived in Philadelphia from London on June 6, 1778. It carried a group of peace commissioners. The three commissioners, led by the Earl of Carlisle, arrived with substantial bargaining power from London, hoping to at long last bring this rebellion to an end. Over the winter of 1777-78, following news of the capture of Burgoyne's army at Saratoga, political leaders in London feared that perhaps they really underestimated the military capacity of the Americans. Perhaps a political compromise could resolve this matter. Many British leaders believed that speed was of the essence. London was already receiving word that France was seriously considering entry into the war through a military alliance with the United States. Britain's bargaining power would be much greater before that happened. Parliament, however, went on recess in December, shortly after word of the defeat at Saratoga arrived in London, and would not meet again for 6 weeks. Members debated taking a shorter recess to deal with events that were quickly developing into war with France. The members, however, voted to retain their extended recess and put off any decisions until the following year. When Parliament returned on January 20, 1778, the North Ministry was ready to get to work. The Ministry got Parliament to support the Taxation of the Colonies Act of 1778. In that act, Parliament repealed the tea tax. It also disclaimed the Declaratory Act, which had maintained Parliament's right to tax the colonies. Going forward, Parliament would only levy tariffs related to the regulation of trade and never to raise revenue. Now, this was exactly what the Patriot leaders had been demanding about a decade earlier. The bill also repealed the Massachusetts Government Act. This was the 1774 law that altered Massachusetts' colonial charter to reduce the colonists' power of self-government, and it was one of the main reasons that the colonists had taken up arms at Lexington and Concord back in 1775. The ministry also got Parliament's approval to send a commission to America to make any further necessary concessions and hopefully reach a peace with the colonies. If London could give in to demands that had originally started the war, perhaps they could reach this political settlement before France entered the war. The man behind this push for a peace commission was William Eden. Eden was the son of a baronet, though since he was not the firstborn, he could not inherit the title. William did, however, get a top-notch education and trained to be a lawyer. His career soon veered into government service in the areas of diplomacy and trade. In 1772, at the age of 27, he received an appointment to serve as Undersecretary of State in the North Ministry. This was due to family connections. He was related to Solicitor General Alexander Wedderburn. 2 years later, Eden won a seat in the House of Commons, but also retained his position as Undersecretary of State. After another 2 years, in 1776, he took a third position as a Lord of Trade. This was a position on the Board of Trade that was one of those honorary positions that paid £1,000 a year, but did not require the salary holder to show up for work. It was the ministry's way of rewarding members of Parliament for political loyalty. Eden, however, took the unusual step of showing up for meetings of the Board of Trade and taking an active role in debate. Through his government positions, he also created for himself an informal job of intelligence officer. Eden began making contacts and sending agents all over Europe to obtain intelligence of interest to the ministry. One of his agents was Paul Wentworth, who I've mentioned before went to Paris to keep tabs on the American commissioners. It was through Eden's intelligence network that the North Ministry received word that France was seriously considering entering the war in early 1777. Now, Eden was no radical Whig. In Parliament, he had supported taxation of the colonies before the war. He also supported the use of a large military to put down the rebellion. But with war with France imminent, Eden became a vocal proponent of a peace commission. And not one of those BS commissions that had gone before with the power to do nothing other than forgive the Americans for their treason. This commission had to make real concessions and as quickly as possible. So during Parliament's winter recess, Eden was the one who put together the proposals for those legislative changes and for the creation of the Peace Commission. He got Prime Minister Lord North's approval, as well as that of Conservative Attorney General Lord Thurlow. Parliament began debate on the conciliatory laws and authorization for the Peace Commission in mid-February, a few weeks after it actually returned to business. By early March, both the House of Commons and the House of Lords had approved the bills and the commission. The relatively speedy approval of the plan after about 3 weeks should not belie the fact that it was quite controversial within Parliament. Many conservative Tories thought that the ministry was essentially giving up on the war after a minor setback at Saratoga and was surrendering to all the colonial demands. At the same time, radical Whigs thought that the reforms and the commission did not go far enough. Leader of the opposition, Lord Rockingham, recommended during debates that the commission be empowered to grant independence to the United States. Rockingham and his faction believed that these were the only conditions that would end the war immediately. This would allow Britain to negotiate a favorable trading relationship with the U.S. and might successfully short-circuit a war with France. Even if France did still go to war with Britain, the U.S. would not be France's ally. The radicals were even calling for Lord North's resignation. They felt that the Americans needed new leadership to accept a real change in policy. The call for American independence began with a few radicals. But as parliamentary debate continued, the war with France began. Concern about the war with France led the pro-independence movement within Parliament to grow. Conservatives had to convince the dying William Pitt, Lord Chatham, to return to the House of Lords to make a final speech in favor of holding on to the colonies. Chatham called the independence of America the dismemberment of the monarchy. Chatham would actually die a few weeks after this speech, but his speech was effective in forestalling any continued debate over recognizing American independence. Even as parliamentary debate on the commission was getting started in February, Lord North sought to have Eden serve on the peace commission that would go to America. Eden, however, was not so crazy about the idea. He feared he would lose his lucrative government positions, so he preferred to stay in London. Instead, he requested an appointment to the king's privy council. The king, however, nixed the idea. He did agree to Eden's request for £1,000 sterling to pay for his duties as a commissioner. The ministry also agreed that he could continue to hold his position as Under Secretary of State and on the Board of Trade while he was away in America. Eden's other big worry was that Lord North might resign while Eden was off in America trying to negotiate a peace, so he demanded a promise from North that he would not resign while Eden was still away. He also got the ministry to promise that it would support a major military operation in America in order to help convince the Americans to accept this negotiated end to the war. So with all that, Eden was on board. The ministry then had to look for some other commissioners. Eden did not think that he should head the commission. His past positions in Parliament in favor of colonial taxation and the use of Native Americans to help suppress the rebellion might make him rather unpopular in the eyes of the Americans. Instead, the head of the commission went to Frederick Howard, the 5th Earl of Carlisle. Lord Carlisle was 29 years old at the time and a member of the House of Lords. He'd done little of note in the government. However, he was a childhood friend of Eden from when the two attended Eton together years earlier. His title made it appropriate for him to lead the commission, and Eden thought that the two men would work well together and that Carlisle would rely on Eden's advice. Parliament's third commissioner was Richard Jackson. As a member of Parliament, Jackson tended to be a radical Whig. Parliament selected him because they thought he'd be popular with the Americans. Jackson had served as a colonial agent before the war and was good friends with Benjamin Franklin. Eden, however, thought that Jackson was a little too radical. He had spoken in favor of recognizing American independence, and that was farther than Eden wanted to go, and farther than the commission was authorized to go. So instead, Eden arranged for Jackson to be replaced on the commission by George Johnstone, a Scottish member of Parliament who had been royal governor of West Florida and was by this time in his 50s. Both Johnstone and Eden seemed in agreement and believed they would work well together. Johnstone was not, however, on the best terms with Secretary of State Lord Germain. The two men had fought a duel against each other in 1770 after Johnstone had questioned Germain's honor. Also added to the commission were Admiral Sir Richard Howe and General William Howe. Recall that the Howe brothers had been appointed as peace commissioners 2 years earlier, but were not given any authority to make political concessions. So technically, the Carlisle Commission were adding these three additional members from Parliament to the commission that already existed by the Howe brothers. It was thought that the commission needed to work with the military commanders because they needed to work in concert with the military to put pressure on the Americans in order for them to accept a negotiated peace. Now, by this time, the ministry had already accepted General Howe's offer to resign and had recalled him to London. However, this was not yet public knowledge and not revealed explicitly to the commission. Instead, the ministry gave the commission authority to swap out Howe's seat with a new North American commander, General Sir Henry Clinton, if they found it appropriate at some future point. With all the details worked out, the commission finally set sail on April 12, 1778, bound for New York. By this time, of course, the officials had wasted at least 4 precious months since the commission's initial conception. During those important months, Britain and France had gone to war, and the Americans had become aware of the signing of the Franco-American Treaty. Before the commissioners even reached New York, they encountered a British naval vessel in mid-passage. The captain informed them that Admiral Howe and General Clinton had both gone to Philadelphia. So the commissioners changed course and headed straight to Philadelphia, since they would need to confer with Clinton and Howe before they began any real negotiations. The commissioners, as I said, arrived in Philadelphia on June 6th, and were surprised to learn that General Howe had already left for London. They were even more surprised to learn that General Clinton was preparing to evacuate Philadelphia. This was the first that the commissioners were hearing about any evacuation plans. Before they left London, Lord Germain had assured the commissioners that the military would engage in an offensive to encourage the Americans to enter these negotiations. Germain had said nothing about the evacuation of Philadelphia, even though he had sent orders to General Clinton to do just that more than a month before the commissioners left London. Eden angrily wrote Germain about having the commission undercut by the evacuation and by Germain's decision not to bother to even mention that fact to the commissioners before they left. Germain's pathetic response was that Eden was supposed to be an intelligence agent who knew all the government secrets, so he should have just known that. The commissioners attempted to get General Clinton to delay the evacuation, but Clinton had direct orders from London and was concerned that a French fleet might trap the British in Philadelphia if he delayed. Now, despite their weakened negotiating position, the commission was able to offer an impressive set of concessions. Parliament had authorized the commission to void any law passed since the Seven Years' War that the Americans found objectionable. The commission could offer the Americans representation in Parliament, or, in the alternative, recognize the Continental Congress as the legitimate representative body of the colonies within the British Empire. It could guarantee that Parliament would never again attempt to levy taxes on the colonies, and that it would never again alter a colonial charter except at the request of the colonial legislature. Further, the commissioners could offer rewards to American leaders who helped to end the war and bring about the peace. There was discussion, for example, of making George Washington a duke. On June 13th, a week after the commission's arrival in Philadelphia, the commissioners sent a message to the Continental Congress in York, essentially saying that they just wanted the war to end and they were willing to discuss pretty much any and all demands that the colonies had articulated as reasons for war and independence. General Washington did not permit the messenger to go to Congress, but did allow the message to be delivered. If the Carlisle Commission had arrived 2 years earlier with these same concessions, they probably would have been met with celebration by the colonies. It almost certainly would have ended hostilities and calls for independence. But this was 1778, not 1776. The Americans had been through too much and had come too far to negotiate a return to colonial status. 4 days after Congress received the message, President Henry Laurens, on behalf of a unanimous Congress, rejected the peace overture and rejected any offers for further meetings. As a condition for any further discussions, the British either had to recognize American independence or remove all military forces from the United States. Also, the Continentals demanded,
"Before we let you leave, your commander must cross that field, present himself before this army, put his head between his legs, and kiss his own arse."
Okay, maybe that last condition wasn't true, but it was just about as likely as either of the first two. The bottom line was that the Americans were committed to full independence by this time and would accept nothing less. Once that happened, they were happy to discuss trade relationships and other friendly intercourse between the two separate countries. In other words, we can be friends, but we're just not into you in that way. Any time for any political compromise that involved rejoining the empire was over. By July, after the British evacuated Philadelphia, which is a subject I'm going to cover in more detail next week, the commission saw that there was no real chance of success. The commission made one desperate attempt from New York on July 11th, explicitly saying that Britain was open to any concession short of independence and that British forces could not evacuate North America due to the war with France. This message reached Congress but received no response. Not wanting to go home in failure, the commission tried to reach out directly to the people, issuing public proclamations of the concessions that they were willing to make. If they thought there was some silent majority that was ready for peace and that only the radicals in Congress would show resistance, they would be quickly disappointed. Patriots around the country held public burnings of the conciliatory bills, making clear that they were not interested in anything less than complete independence. Attempts to get loyalists talking about a negotiated peace only stirred up patriots to publish more pamphlets about the importance of independence. Lord Carlisle wrote to his wife that the arrival of the French fleet, quote, "makes every hope of success in our business ridiculous." Eden even wrote to Lord Wedderburn that had he known of the decision to evacuate Philadelphia, he never even would have come to America. Britain could not negotiate from a position of strength, and the commission only looked weak and craven. He wanted to return home, but officials in London urged him to stay with the commission, which had moved to New York and was continuing its efforts. Many believed the ministry wanted him to stay, not because they believed there was any chance of success, but more because they didn't want him to return to Parliament and join the opposition. To make matters worse, Commissioner George Johnstone attempted to bribe at least three members of Congress, Francis Dana, Joseph Reed, and Robert Morris. The delegates all reported the attempted bribery, and Congress declared that no patriot could have any communications with such a dishonorable character without bringing their own reputation into question. The other members of the commission had to distance themselves from Johnstone and said they had no knowledge of what he was doing. Johnstone had to resign from the commission and return to England. There, he returned to Parliament and continued with his successful political career in support of the ministry. By the end of August, the commission released another pronouncement that further attempts at conciliation were futile, and that if the Americans wanted to resume discussions, they would have to initiate the talks. Back in London, the king had received initial reports of the failure to start talks in June and told Lord North, quote, "The present accounts from America put a stop to all negotiations. Further concession is a joke." In October, the commission issued one last proclamation, making an offer to any individuals or states that wanted to seek a peace with Britain and return to the empire. The proclamation went on to emphasize the dangers to the Americans in allying themselves with their traditional enemy, France, and that resulted in Lafayette challenging Eden to a duel. Eden declined, noting that badmouthing an enemy during a time of war was not dishonorable. The proclamation also threatened that the war would become even more harsh as Britain took off the gloves in this all-out war against France and those who allied themselves with their enemy. Eden had suggested privately that military leaders send in guerrilla units into the continent to engage in continuing acts of destruction and devastation in order to convince the people to demand a peaceful resolution. That, of course, never happened. The only thing the commission managed to do was restore trade privileges to loyalists living in New York City or Newport, Rhode Island, the only two areas within the United States where Britain still had a significant military presence. By the end of 1778, the commission had given up completely and returned to England. The commissioners continued to try to convince the ministry to apply more military pressure to North America, but by that time, the ministry was focused on other concerns with France. The commission finally disbanded on June 1, 1779. Next week, the British pack up and evacuate Philadelphia. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. My thanks to Trey Nance, George Davis, and Lewis White for their continued support of this podcast at the Alexander Hamilton Club level on Patreon. Thanks also to Mike Hager for support at the Robert Morris Circle level. Also, thanks to longtime supporters Eric Bloomquist Jordan, John Pinella, and Mason Pierce for their continued support on Patreon as well. I really appreciate everyone who can chip in to help me cover expenses. Also, thanks to everyone who has made one-time contributions, be it PayPal or Venmo. All of your support really helps this whole thing to keep going. This week, we looked at the Carlisle Peace Commission, which was really an all-out effort to end the war. The big question from all this is, why were the British so willing to give up on all the reasons that they had for starting the war in the first place? Successful monarchies know when to take power and when to give power. If a king can take land, wealth, or eliminate a foe without risking his power, he will. If he finds himself in a situation where ceding power will smooth things out, he'll do that. It's the sort of wheeling and dealing in power that saw the rise and fall of so many families in the Middle Ages. Now, before the Revolution, British leaders thought they could get away with imposing more restrictions on the colonies, with the clear endgame of extracting more wealth from those colonies for the leadership in London. By 1778, those leaders had recognized that they'd overplayed their hand. They were at risk of losing not only the colonies in America, but many more valuable colonies in other parts of the empire, because the French monarchy smelled British weakness and was prepared to take what it could from Britain. British leaders were essentially willing to give up on all the power grabs they had attempted on the colonies since the end of the Seven Years' War, because, despite not collecting any real taxes from the colonies, the relationship back then was a good one for Britain. London controlled the terms of all trade from the colonies, meaning British merchants in Britain could get cheap resources. Colonies could not sail around the world looking for the best price. They had to take what they could get in Britain. There were massive more benefits to this trading relationship where one side gets to control all of the trade rules, much more benefits than they could probably ever get from taxes. So, the Carlisle Commission was trying to help the ministry reestablish that valuable trading relationship by giving up on its claims for taxes. They also hoped that happy colonists would once again support Britain against France, also important for the balance of power in Europe. The problem was that the British had already overplayed their hand. The colonists no longer trusted them on the issue of taxes. Whatever promises London made in 1778 regarding power sharing and no taxation might just as easily disappear at some future time when Britain had the upper hand. Also, by this time, the colonists were viewing Britain as a bit of a paper tiger. The regulars looked scary, but they could not assert any control over more than a few cities. Especially now with a French ally, Americans saw no reason to go back under Britain's rule. The opposition in Parliament had accepted that the ministry had overplayed its hand, and it wanted to grant independence as a surer way of absolutely cutting its losses at this point and moving on. Granting independence would still allow Britain to rebuild a trading relationship with America. It couldn't make all the rules, but it could still benefit greatly from such a trade. Acceding to American independence would also end the costs of waging war in America, both in terms of men and money, so that Britain could focus on France. As it will turn out, and hopefully this isn't a spoiler for anyone, the opposition was right, and the administration really should have cut its losses completely in 1778. It would take the ministry, though, another 4 or 5 years to reach that conclusion. Without the benefit of hindsight, the ministry's decision not to give in made some sense. Even if it costs more to put down a rebellion than you might ever recover, an empire needs to set examples. If it gave in to a colonial uprising every time a colony put up a decent fight, that would just encourage more colonies to put up a fight. Britain did not want colonies in the Caribbean or India or even Ireland or Scotland to start getting ideas that London was not willing to fight hard for its possessions. If you want to get a better understanding of the British perspective, you may want to try this week's book recommendation. It is Rebels and Redcoats, The American Revolution Through British Eyes, by Christopher Hibbert. This book mentioned the Carlisle Commission only in passing. It's really more about how British attitudes and understanding of the Americans changed over the course of the war, and how Britain finally came to accept American independence. The author, Christopher Hibbert, is a very prolific author of histories and biographies, mostly from Britain and Europe. He published Rebels and Redcoats back in 1990. Sadly, Mr. Hibbert passed away in 2008. But as I said, if you're looking for a better understanding of the British perspective, take a look at Rebels and Redcoats. If you're interested in more specifics really on today's topic about the Carlisle Commission, my online recommendation is a master's thesis written by John Savage in 1968. It is called Britain's Conciliatory Proposal of 1778, A Study in Futility. This is an in-depth look at the creation of the Carlisle Commission and its efforts in America. It's nearly 200 pages long and provides lots of great details on this particular topic. You can find it at the University of Richmond Scholarship Repository at scholarship.richmond.edu. Just search for Britain's Conciliatory Proposal. Or you can use the direct link that I put on my website or blog. Go to blog.amrevpodcast.com for more details. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.